Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Dr. Saad Usmani, the Chief of the Myeloma Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And I'm joined by my dear colleague, Dr. Amrita Krishnan, who is the Professor of Medicine at the City of Hope in Los Angeles, California. These are our disclosures. Today, our learning objectives will focus on outlining practical strategies for implementing new and evolving standards of care into treatment of patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma, summarizing clinical data supporting the use of triplet and quadruplet regimens in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients, correlating patient and/or disease characteristics with appropriate triplet or quadruplet regimens in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma, including both transplant-eligible and ineligible patients, identifying factors to be considered when developing an optimized treatment sequencing strategy for an individual newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patient. Let's start the first section. The title of this particular section is called Distilling Data in Frontline Treatments of Patients with Newly Diagnosed Multiple Myeloma. And we're focusing on emerging standards of care. Multiple myeloma is a systemic plasma cell malignancy. It's estimated that in the year 2021, there were almost 35,000 newly diagnosed cases and a little over 12,000 patients who died from this disease. And this incidence continues to grow over time. However, the good news is that the percentage of patients who are surviving the disease beyond 5 years has more than doubled in the last two decades and stands at about 55.6%. The median age at diagnosis is 69 years in general, but it is a bit younger, or a little less in terms of age in Black adults. Multiple myeloma is most common in men, and it is the most common hematologic malignancy in the Black population, and they tend to present at an earlier age. One of the things that we like to highlight is the fact that myeloma is not one disease. It has many different molecular subgroups. And these molecular subgroups, which we think there are between 6 to 8 different ones, depending on how you define them, they have different biologic behaviors. And those genomic changes are present from the MGUS stage onwards. And this MGUS to active myeloma transition is occurring at a different time point in different patients, and it depends on the interaction of the myeloma cells with the bone marrow microenvironment. So we see these patients with different degree of end organ damage during this course or journey of MGUS to active myeloma. The good news is that management strategies and new therapies have improved multiple myeloma survivorship from a median of 2 to 3 years back in the early 2000s to over 10 years in the 2020s. Now we're focused on finding the right strategy for patients that gives them the highest likelihood of the deepest responses, especially in their first year of diagnosis. I think, all of us, in the myeloma community kind of agree that depth of response, achieving it and sustaining it is very important for survival outcomes. And we have this, treatment paradigm that we've lived with now for almost, two decades. And I'm going to get some opinion from my colleague, Dr. Krishnan, on this, because, I think she would agree that this will probably change, as we're getting newer cellular therapies and bispecific antibodies into the scheme of myeloma treatment. But, for newly diagnosed patients, even today, we think about them in transplant ineligible and eligible categories. The idea of that initial induction therapy with or without stem cell transplantation is to get patients into as deep a response as possible. And then the maintenance phase is geared towards, maintaining that depth of response. And we also pay attention to supportive care in terms of managing, bone health, infection risk, overall well-being, pain management for our patients. And at a time point when the disease does come back, we restage patients and reassess try to find the best available option for the patients at that set of point in time. And the management plan for our patients, even during that early phase of treatment, is dynamic. It's not that the train has left the station and it's not going to change its course. It's a multidisciplinary kind of an approach that we typically take for our patients because this patient population is a little bit older in general. And when we develop and implement the plan, we are monitoring both the response to treatment as well as the safety or adverse event profile for patients. And then we revise that treatment plan and via data gathering and continue to implement it. So, these are some general guidelines on how we're approaching myeloma treatment. And I do want to move to this next section, and this is where I would love to get even before I start this section, I'd love to get some input from Dr. Krishnan. So, I'm going to be talking about transplant ineligible myeloma patients and how we're managing them today based on data. But Dr. Krishnan, what do you think? Do you think that we are still going to be thinking about transplant eligibility or ineligibility in the future with all the data that's emerging?
Thank you, Dr. Somani. I think you may end up adding a third bucket now, is T-cell directed therapy eligible or not? And I'm sure you're going to be covering a couple of those studies in regards to some of the bispecific T-cell engagers being used in the newly diagnosed setting in patients not intended for transplant, and also in terms of CAR T as well, same idea in terms of patients not intended for transplant. So I think I agree with you that transplant ineligible is probably going to go away, and it may be just not intended for upfront transplant.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, we are going to probably move in that direction within the next 2 to 3 years. As some of those trials that I'm going to mention kind of come to the fore. So building on that, currently, this is our approach at MSK for our transplant ineligible patients. And transplant ineligibility is deemed by the base on the basis of performance status or comorbidities for patients. And it's two of these three drug combinations. It's either RVD light for 8 to 12 cycles or until response plateau before patients move on to maintenance treatment. If they have standard risk disease, it's lenalidomide only. If it is a high-risk disease, we still try to keep them on the PI maintenance in addition to lenalidomide. And then for patients who start off on the daratumumab-based triplet DRD regimen, we typically tend to continue this treatment. Once patients have had a response plateau, we may tweak the regimen or discontinue one of the drugs, but that really is a patient specific decision that we typically tend to make. And where do these data come from? I think the RVD data really starts from the SWOG777 study, which looked at RVD versus RD as induction for patients without immediate intent for stem cell transplant. So this study showed superiority of the PIMID induction compared to just RD induction for both PFS and OS. One critique of this study is that the median patient population age was in the mid-60s, so it included patients who would have been transplant eligible, by age or performance status. However, the bottom line is that this regimen, validated the practice of using a three-drug combination for our newly diagnosed myeloma patients, both in the transplant eligible as well as ineligible settings. However, the regimen that most of us use for the older patients is the RVD light regimen, which was developed, or examined at Mass General by our colleagues, Doctors Betsy O'Donnell and Nupur Ajay. And it's a single-arm study using lower doses of lenalidomide at 15 milligrams and weekly dosing of bortezomib, but showing very similar, response rates as well as PFS for this older patient population of median of 73 years. And what they had shown in terms of safety, is good tolerability. Patients did have peripheral neuropathy with this approach, about two-thirds of the patients, but they were grade one and two and reversible, according to this report. I think, the more important study, which is perhaps more relevant to what we are going to be discussing, for this older patient population right now is the daratumumab Lendex combination. So this was an approved regimen that was approved almost 3 years ago, if I remember correctly, based on the phase III MAIA trial that compared this three-drug combination to Lendex, which at that time was deemed the standard of care for this patient population based on the first clinical trial. And if you look at this patient population, the median age was 73 and 74. In fact, 75 or older age made up 44% of the patient population that enrolled on the study. So, really a very relevant, older transplant ineligible patient population here. Overall response rates with, daratumumab Lendex were 93% with a very high proportion of patients getting to a very good partial response or better, at the almost 5 year follow-up mark, that percentage was 81%. If we look at the PFS and overall survival at the 40, 56-month median follow-up, the median PFS was still not reached for DRD, whereas it was 34.4 months for RD. And the median OS had not been reached in either arm, it became statistically significant in favor of DRD at that mark with a hazard ratio of 0.68. Demonstrating that DRD, is a very effective regimen. And because the median PFS is still not reached, this will be a very challenging benchmark for the other clinical trials evaluating patients in this patient, in this population. The field is kind of moving on from that, and now, this debate of whether we should use a PI or an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody with Lendex in this older patient population to say, how about we just combine these therapies together? The Cepheus trial is fully enrolled. This study, began right before the pandemic hit, actually, comparing the combination of daratumumab along with VRd as part of induction compared to VRd as part of induction, and then both the arms got RD. Essentially, this is a comparison of the SWOG 777 approach, versus including daratumumab as part of induction treatment within that SWOG 777 approach. So this is just an induction question of incorporating daratumumab into the frontline setting. In a very similar kind of a way, the other anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody isatuximab, is being studied in the IMbrave trial. But here, the therapy in addition to receiving isatuximab with VRd, the maintenance is continuous with ISA Lendex until relapse or progression, whereas the standard of care arm on this study is the SWOG 777 way of treating patients. So both very interesting, studies in a very common patient population out in the community. And if we look at the global myeloma care, I think, both these trials will be very important. And then lastly, This is a very exciting study. Dr. Krishnan kind of alluded to this study. This is the CARTITUDE-5 trial, where the standard of care arm is the SWOG777 study again. Patients who are getting VRd as part of their induction treatment, followed by RD as maintenance. In the experimental arm, after that phase of VRd induction treatment, the experimental arm gets the BCMA-directed CAR T-cell therapy, cilta-cel, which all of us know is very active in both late relapsed and even in early relapsed multiple myeloma. I think this whole discussion around transplant ineligibility and how we're approaching newly diagnosed multiple myeloma will likely, change in the next few years based on, these clinical trials. I do want to highlight before I, turn things over to Dr. Krishnan to talk about the transplant-eligible patient population approach on, this discussion that we've been having, within the myeloma community about the older, frail patients and how to extrapolate data, from these transplant-ineligible studies for those patients. Many programs are starting to incorporate comprehensive geriatric assessments and partnering with their with geriatric oncology colleagues in evaluating the older myeloma patients. This is a slide courtesy of Dr. Tanya Wiles, who has been a champion for older myeloma patient care, where, she and her colleagues evaluate patients, with comprehensive geriatric assessments and then utilizes dose-attenuated regimens in those patients. We're seeing some clinical trials emerge through the U.S. Cooperative Group mechanism as well. Dr. Krishnan, before you go to your talk, what are your thoughts around this and, are you thinking about incorporating this kind of a schema or approach in your older patients?
We certainly have a center for geriatric oncology at City of Hope as well. I think the challenge has been, to be honest, in regard to the resources and to be able to do the geriatric assessment. I think everyone agrees it's very important, but how to do it in a way that, one, is fairly efficient, number two, that you're adequately supported to be able to do it. I think that's where it's still a work in progress. I mean, there's a lot of ideas now in terms of using technology to assist with that. My colleague, Dr. Nathwani, has published on using an iPad, screening for geriatric assessment. Anything we can do to help make it streamlined, I think will help us use it more.
No, I completely agree with you. We need more people like Dr. Wiles and Dr. Nathwani to be doing, this work in our respective teams and really taking this on. All right. With that being said, Dr. Krishnan, I'll turn things over to you, to talk about approaches towards transplant-eligible patients.
Thank you, Dr. Usmani. Some of my themes will be pretty similar to yours, which tells you that this idea of transplant eligible and not eligible is fading away, and some of the regimens will look also very familiar because, again, we really, those groups are starting to merge closer and closer together. You've already sort of outlined this well. Everyone's myeloma is different. It's not one disease, and the pace of disease can be different. We've all had patients who've been in remission 10, 15 years versus those who continue to relapse, and it's not always driven just by cytogenetics. It makes us realize there's a lot more in regards to adequately treating myeloma that we need to understand, and certainly the immune microenvironment is a big part of that and in part why we're so interested in these other T-cell-based therapies. Also, obviously, the idea of clonal evolution of myeloma that you alluded to, as well as patients' progress through the various stages of their myeloma is important as we think about targeted therapies. In fact, even more so if we're going to really focus on BCMA-targeted therapies, and this idea of relapse post those therapies? Is it a new clone? Is it a BCMA-resistant clone, for example? Those are all very interesting concepts that we're learning more about. So first of all, I think you won't disagree with this slide because this is your slide. So thank you for sharing that. But in terms of, again, the idea that why do we stratify patients to help in terms of the prognosis for them? But even more importantly now, I think I would say we're using stratification to help guide therapy in regards to, as we'll talk about the MASTER study, first in ideas of stopping therapy after patients achieve a deep remission, for example. And also in terms of are we going to use a quadruplet versus a triplet induction? How intense are we going to be about our maintenance therapy? All those decisions now are in part based on risk stratification. Ultimately, we hope to be more biomarker driven, and some of that we're doing, you alluded to that, in the high-risk population using proteasome inhibitors. Eventually, one hopes to see that in terms of patients with t(11;14), the use of BCL-2 inhibitors more and more, maybe even in the frontline setting, for example. And we all acknowledge the patients with p53 deletion, and especially those with more than one high-risk chromosome abnormality, remain a big challenge for us. I think you spoke to this very well. You know, our first shot is our best shot, and that's, I think, what we need to keep doing in regards to being aggressive at our initial induction therapy, because many patients never make it to those later lines of therapy. And that's also why there's an interest in moving many of these new therapies earlier and earlier in the course of the disease. You already said this, and I completely agree. The goal of our therapy is to get a response quickly, to get a deep response and a long response. Ultimately, we want to make sure that those responses are translated to better quality of life. Ultimately, we want to cure the disease, and one could argue that cure means being able to stop therapy as well. So let's talk about this idea of transplant. We had a long discussion earlier about not intended for transplant. Well, here we have the phase three randomized study looking at, I really don't think of it as a transplant versus no transplants, but more as an early versus delayed transplant trial using RVD induction and patients being randomized to RVD versus RVD followed by transplant, followed by RVD consolidation, and both arms getting len maintenance until disease progression. The primary endpoint of the determination study was progression-free survival, and you could see that it was clearly met with an improved progression-free survival of 67 months in the autologous transplant arm. If you look at cytogenetic risk, and again, back to our initial point of risk stratification, you can see even more so for those high-risk patients, transplant seems to benefit them with a PFS of 55 versus 17 months only in the RVD alone arm. But even in standard-risk patients, you could see a benefit, again, in terms of PFS to early transplant. If you look in terms of this idea of getting a deep remission, that holds true as well. The patients who became MRD negative seem to have the longest PFS. One could argue that that holds true whether or not you get a transplant for sure, but my bias would be your chance of becoming MRD negative is certainly higher in the transplant arm versus the non-transplant arm. And this is a summary slide from the ASCO presentation by Dr. Richardson in regards to the determination key findings that it met the primary endpoint of an overall progression-free survival benefit with early transplant in the upfront setting. To remind you, the study used len until disease progression, and this continued to support that idea, though that may be one area where the field is continuing to evolve. To acknowledge there is no overall survival difference right now with a median follow-up of 76 months. Nonetheless, I would purport that one, this trial was not designed for that. It was designed for PFS. Number two, survival in myeloma patients is continuing to improve and evolve. So demonstrating OS benefits is much more challenging and may not necessarily always be what drives our decision-making process. I would also point out the important point that there was no difference in the overall rate of second primary malignancies in both arms. There was a slightly higher incidence of AML-MDS in the transplant arm, but overall that rate was not statistically significantly different. And again, another area where the field's evolving in terms of trying to understand who is at higher risk for getting these second malignancies, and the idea of CHIPS, for example, at baseline may also help guide our therapy. Now, of course, the field doesn't end there, and VRd was the gold standard when this trial was done, but that's rapidly evolving, and one could argue that K is the new V now, and we certainly have data from Dr. Gay and colleagues in terms of the FORTE study looking at KRd plus or minus transplant. And you could see certainly KRd superior to KCD. There was a second randomization in this study to KR versus R. Same theme here that OS is not different, but this is relatively early follow-up, and certainly there was a PFS benefit to the KR arm, especially in those challenging patients, the high-risk groups, so those who had gain of 1q. This didn't show up well, but in terms of 17p, the one group that remains the big challenge was amplification of 1q, so four or more copies. Even those patients did not seem to benefit from the KR versus R maintenance. So again, suggesting we still have room to think about newer therapies for these very high-risk patients. Now, Dr. Usmani talked about quadruplet induction in the non-transplant setting. Here we have it in the transplant setting with the GRIFFIN study, Dara-RVd versus RVd, a phase II randomized study. You can see that the quadruplet arm had a much higher response rate and, even more importantly, greater depth of response, and those responses deepened over time. And now we also have a progression-free survival benefit for the quadruplet arm compared to the triplet RVd arm at 87 versus 70%, suggesting, at least in my mind, that for the majority of patients, we are now moving towards a quadruplet-based induction. And I think this is the other big question that's always come out and is the idea in terms of subgroups, especially those high-risk subgroups. And there does seem to be a benefit for that quadruplet in those high-risk patients, including those with 1q abnormalities. Again, I think the same concept we've been seeing with CD38 antibodies, it can help improve outcomes for high-risk patients, but it can't bring them back to the same as standard risk. And of course, that is not the only anti-CD38 antibody there. We also have isatuximab, and here we have the GMMMG-HD7 study of isa-RVd versus RVd. You see a same similar theme in terms of higher rates of response and deeper responses in the quadruplet arm. At 50% MRD negative at the end of induction versus 35% in the VRd arm alone. And I think this is the one that I find the most interesting because it sort of puts it all together, in regards to using KRd and using an anti-CD38 antibody. So isa-KRd in the German CONCEPT study. And there's both a transplant arm and a non-transplant arm using, again, intensive induction, intensive consolidation, and intensive maintenance, as you can see here. And what you see is, again, small numbers of patients in the early paper, 50 patients, but 100% response rate with 90% of patients getting a VGPR or better. This trial, initial PFS was very encouraging, 79% at 12 months. This trial is going to be updated at ASH this year. This is what we know so far from the abstract that's been released, that in the transplant population now we have a 68% MRD negative rate, 54% in the non-transplant population. And an overall response rate, 94% in the transplant-eligible population. What we're really waiting for is in regards to the PFS, and they've kind of left that as a teaser that they're going to present the updated PFS results at the ASH meeting. So we certainly will await that. But I would say that one can see here that quadruplet induction helps us get closer to our goal of a deep response and hopefully a long response. But ultimately, we also want to stop therapy. And here we have the master study using MRD to help guide us in regards to stopping therapy. Very intensive induction, Dara-KRd transplant, Dara-KRd consolidation, and then len maintenance with MRD at multiple time points. I do point out that the MRD is to the 10 to the minus 5. And you can see that certainly with this intensive regimen, you get very high response rates and high depth of response as well. 98% of patients' VGPR are better by the time they get to consolidation. And you can see that certainly a very encouraging progression-free survival in patients with zero or one high-risk cytogenetic abnormality. Challenging still in regards to those ultra-high-risk patients with two or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities. And I think this is probably the most important point of this to me is even if you become MRD negative in a high-risk cytogenetic, the ultra-high-risk patients, unfortunately, stopping therapy in that group of patients, they have a very high rate of MRD resurgence or progression. So it says that for that group of patients, we still need to think about new treatment approaches. And here is one of the sort of teasers of one of the proposed new treatment approaches, the Master 2.0, which you can see here is now incorporating T-cell engagers as part of that consolidation approach. So again, interesting, and we'll see the future of how that may influence us being able to stop therapy. And this is the extended follow-up from the Master studies showing the same idea again that the two or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities still have a very much lower PFS, even in those who become MRD negative. And so we still are interested, though, in stopping therapy, and we have the Perseus study. We're waiting to get a readout on that. The primary endpoint was PFS. The interesting part of this study was the randomization to Rev or Dara-Rev maintenance, and then MRD assessment, and then patients being able to come off of at least the Dara, but maintained on both arms, maintained on Rev, to see at least if you can de-escalate. So it doesn't completely stop therapy, but again, another idea of using MRD to help guide our therapy. And then the SWOG, a dramatic study, in fact, does stop therapy. So patients get any induction, get a transplant, get randomized to len Dara or len alone. At 2 years, they have another MRD assessment, and those patients who are MRD negative are randomized to either continuing or stopping therapy on their assigned arm. So this, I would say, in a true randomized fashion, will help us answer this question about can you stop therapy if you get a deep response? And again, I'd like to acknowledge all my colleagues at our Briskin Myeloma Center. It truly takes a village to treat myeloma. Thank you.
Now, thank you so much, Dr. Krishnan, for such an outstanding overview of everything that's going on in a very busy transplant eligible patient population. And I think that there are other strategies that will likely be incorporated. Things that we have not included is how the bispecifics are being planned, in that frontline strategy. So perhaps in another year or two, we are going to be talking about some of that information.
Yeah, I would tell you, say, certainly for you, Majestic 7, for example, in regards to Tec-Dara-Len versus Dara-Len-Dex, I think will be a very interesting study for
Yeah.
us.
No, I completely agree. All right, so just to summarize things for our audience, the field is fairly dynamic right now. I think one thing that we agree upon, as a principle, is trying to get patients into as good a response as possible with the optimal strategy from the time they're diagnosed onwards. Does not matter if they're transplant eligible or not. And even that definition is going to be changing in the future, as CAR T cell therapies and even the bispecific antibodies, which we did not talk about much during this conversation, these are strategies that are making their way into the frontline treatment, and the conversation will likely, evolve, around our optimal strategies for those frontline treatments. And then the other point that Dr. Krishnan highlighted is we're trying to move towards more tailored treatment between statin and high-risk patients, and even thinking about defining duration of treatment for patients. Dr. Krishnan, any other thoughts from our discussion so far?
I think just the speed of which the field is moving is pretty remarkable that we had, our first bispecific T-cell engager approved in October 2022, and we're already talking now about trials opening using it in the frontline setting. So I think that is fantastic for patients. I think some of this is a learning curve, though, the same way when some of the other drugs first came out, for example, with T-cell engagers and the infection risk. So again, as we use it in the frontline setting, I think this idea of stopping therapy after fixed duration will be also important because we obviously want to maximize benefit and minimize risk.
And then just thinking about, we have the ASH meeting, with a lot of new data being presented, and many of us are going to be there live. For the last few years, we've seen a lot of focus on BCMA as a target of different modalities. What do you think is, are the more exciting things that you're going to be, looking forward to at ASH, Dr. Krishnan?
I think the data on the FCRH5 targeting the drug cevostamab is going to be very interesting. That's probably an underrepresented target. I think the nice thing about the CIVO is the data that's going to be presented at ASH of discontinuing and continued responses in patients even when they're off therapy, which is very encouraging for us. Obviously, GPRC5D is the other new kid on the block, but now we actually have two bispecific T-cell engagers targeting GPRC and also CAR T targeting GPRC5D. So I think that certainly is of great interest. And the future discussions are going to be how do you sequence these bispecific T-cell engagers and how do you sequence CAR T in that mix as well.
Yeah, and I agree. It was actually good to see, several GPRC5D targeting strategies. And then, for BCMA, I was also intrigued by some of the combination data that's going to be shared, beyond just the antibody combinations. I think there's a BCMA anti-CD38 IMiD combination data that's also being shared. So I'm really looking forward to that because that lays the platform for frontline strategies for some of the patient populations that we talked about in our discussion.